Catholic Family Podcast presents Lent Around the World, daily traditional Catholic meditations read by our friends from across the globe.
The Passion and Death of Our Lord Jesus Christ by the Most Reverend Alban Goodyear, Chapter 9, Part 25, The Second Trial Before Pilate, Barabbas. Pilate could scarcely have been greatly disappointed when he heard the howling cortege coming up the street, bringing its victim back to him. He knew Herod well and his cunning. When he sent him to the Galilean, it was only a forlorn hope. He had thought that perhaps, in a moment of impetuous anger, possibly helped by excess, with a little encouragement from others, Herod might have acted with Jesus as he had acted before, and might have done his prisoner to death. But again, his strategy had failed, and he must shoulder the responsibility. He would do it as became a Roman. He would pull himself together. He would begin all over again from the beginning. He would sum up the evidence as it stood, prove to these men the injustice of their cause, and see whether he could not bring them to their senses. Not that Jesus was of much concern to him. He would betray no sign of that. It was the formality of justice that must be observed, and he would see that all observed it. On the present evidence, a compromise was possible. No doubt, indeed, quite evidently, the accused had given some cause for all this animosity, therefore some kind of punishment might reasonably be dealt out to him. If that were sanctioned, perhaps these bloodhounds would be satisfied. And as for Jesus, in the end, to punish him would be to save him, and that would be the greatest service Pilate could render. In these terms, Pilate soothed his conscience, satisfied his sense of justice, and prepared his address. It was surely sound common sense, such as any thinking man would accept. Justice, but not bigotry. Mercy, but not softness. Judicious compromise. A little to be yielded to and from both sides. It was a perfect sentence in a complicated case, according to all the standards. He went out again upon the balcony. He called the leaders to him, as near as they would come, and began his oration. There was a sense of boredom in his manner, as if the matter did not concern him, as if he were making this concession merely to humor those whom he wished to placate. And Pilate, calling together the chief priests and the magistrates of the people, said to them, "You have brought this man to me as one that perverteth the people. And behold, I, having examined him before you, find no cause in this man touching those things wherein you accuse him. No, nor yet Herod, for I sent you to him. And behold, nothing worthy of death is done to him. I will chastise him, therefore, and release him. Therefore, because he is not guilty, he shall be chastised. Because no man can accuse him of sin, he shall be scourged. Because for his good works no man can blame him, he shall be punished. Because he did all things well, because this great prophet has risen up among them, and God hath visited his people, because this is indeed the prophet that was to come into the world, because he is a good man, because everything that John said concerning him is true, his people must look on him with hatred, must chastise him, must let him know that he is an intruder into this world which belongs to man." Pilate's argument was strange, but it was nothing very new. It was childishly false, but it is acted on to this day. And Jesus stood there, listening to this first sentence passed upon him, and said no word. Who did no sin? Neither was guile found in his mouth, who when he was reviled, did not revile. When he suffered, he threatened not, but delivered himself to him that judged him unjustly. At this point in the trial, there occurred a diversion which Pilate thought he might use to advantage. Besides those who had come to his door with the chief priests and elders, demanding the blood of Jesus, there were others there who had come for an opposite purpose. For the Pasch was the festival that kept alive the memory of the people's release from their Egyptian bondage. In keeping with that memory, the custom had grown up for the governor to release some prisoner that day at the people's request. It was taken as symbolic, It was an empty implication that, after all, in spite of the Roman domination, the Jews were their own masters, were free. The ceremony took place on this day, the eve of the Pasch, and there was always gathered round his door a group of the people, both to make the petition and to receive the released man from the governor's hands. Such a group had come together while the enemies of Jesus had been away at the house of Herod. When they returned, they naturally overwhelmed the former. But in the interval after Pilate's declaration, the petitioner succeeded in making themselves heard. His words had set the accusers thinking. They were apparently final. They had been spoken as a definite decision. It would seem that in their absence, the weak man had nerved himself to act with strength and do his duty. But when the new cry was raised by the second party, that the custom of the paschal season should be observed at once, the innate fickleness of Pilate was revealed. After all, he had not wholly meant what he had just said. The demand was made that a prisoner should be released, one whom the people themselves might name. Here was another opportunity. He would offer Jesus to them, though he had already said he would release him. If he did it at their demand, his reputation would be the better saved. This group seemed more humane than the other. Probably in it were some of the prisoner's friends. He would appeal to it in opposition to the clamors for blood. He would do more. He would give them a choice between two such as would almost compel them to decide for Jesus. There was in the prison, under guard, one criminal who had of late made himself specially notorious, whose execution was only too eagerly desired by the people. He was a highwayman, and on that account alone, in the eyes of the inhabitants of Judea, death was only his long-merited reward. He was a convicted murderer, and for those whose law was an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, he could look for nothing else but to die. He was a sedition monger who had found occupation in stirring up the people, and since this was the charge, preferred but not as yet proven, against Jesus, there could be no choice between him and the one whose guilt was notorious. Pilate's confidence was renewed. He would bring this man out and put him by the side of Jesus. He would ask them to choose between the two. Jesus the Nazarene might indeed be hated, but none would deny that Barabbas was indefinitely more worthy of hate. There was another consideration which had now become more clear in Pilate's mind, and which further led him to hope for victory. With all their clamor against Jesus as a maker of sedition, he knew these leaders of the Jews too well. He did not trust this new enthusiasm for the cause of Rome. If they cried out against the kingship of Jesus, against his winning the people, it was not because of the Roman emperor. It was because of themselves, because they saw in him a challenge to their own jurisdiction. This had been brought home to him the more by what his prisoner had said about himself. He had confessed that he was indeed a king, but no enemy to Caesar for all that. He had a kingdom, but it was not a kingdom of this world. All this coincided with what he knew already of the difficult, bigoted enthusiasts whom he had to govern. These visionaries who had little use for the comforts and luxuries of Rome, yet who could live in a wealth of luxury that would dazzle any Roman. These students who cared almost nothing for the culture of the empire because they had an ascetic culture of their own, who would look with contempt on the comfortable gods of Rome and Greece, worshipping instead a hidden, intangible being in whom they professed to live, whose sway they recognized as that of any overlord, with whom it were wiser, even for a Roman emperor, not to come into conflict. All this Pilate knew, as every Eastern governor knew it, and he had been warned from headquarters to leave all questions of religion discreetly alone. But though he left it alone, it was clear that this Jesus of Nazareth did not. He had interfered. He had called himself a king. He had called himself Christ, the anointed king. As such, he had put himself above the elders and priests. It had begun to grow upon Pilate, whatever the words of their charge. This, he knew full well, was their real cause of grievance. Pilate was determined to use this, possibly his last, opportunity. He would see whether he could put the people, who called for the release of a prisoner, against their leaders, who called for the death of one man. He had before them the evident contrast between Jesus and Barabbas. He would strengthen this by what he now knew of the spiritual side of the one he hoped to save. If the leaders were not to be influenced, the people at least might yield. And when the multitude was come up, they began to desire what he had always done to them. And Pilate answered them and said, "You have a custom that I should release one unto you at the Pasch. Will you, therefore, that I release unto you the King of the Jews? Whom will you that I release to you, Barabbas or Jesus, who is called Christ?" For he knew that through envy the priests had delivered him up. This was a new kind of offensive, and for a moment there was silence in the crowd. Jesus stood there in bonds before them all, the convict Barabbas behind him. Now indeed the prophecy was being fulfilled. He was reputed with the wicked. He was being held up before his own people, side by side with the worst of criminals, that they might make their choice between the two. Had they been left to themselves, it can scarcely be doubted which they would have chosen. They who a few months before, despite the efforts of the Pharisees, had decided in his favor on the witness of John the Baptist. John indeed did no sign, but all things whatsoever John said of this man were true, and many believed in him. But they were not left long to decide for themselves. This was a vital moment, and their leaders dared not let it slip by. Pilate had weakened his sentence. In spite of his decision, he had opened the question again. At once, they were busy among the crowd, whispering here, boasting there, cajoling some, threatening others, and every way imposing their authority, their superior knowledge, their science, their art, on a poor, ignorant mob that knew no better, that stood in awe of these keepers of the temple. Jesus had been found guilty by their own high priest. Was not that evidence enough? He had been treated with contempt and put to shame, and had been unable to speak a word or perform one act to witness in his own defense. Did not that prove that in spite of all he had said and done before, he was a deceiver? Herod had shown him up as a fool. Pilate the Roman was evidently in his favor. Did not this show that there was collusion between them? That this Jesus, breaker of the law of Moses as he had always been, scorner of the true sons of Abraham, was secretly too an ally of the Romans? That as for Barabbas, culprit as he was he not also a victim of Roman tyranny? What loyal Jew would hesitate to choose between them? With all his crimes, let the good Jew Barabbas be preferred. With all his seeming innocence, let the dangerous, magnetizing Jesus be sent to his death. Pilate waited while the decision was being made. He sat on his seat of judgment, hoping against hope. Meanwhile, as he waited, a strange thing occurred. The wife of Pilate was within, in the seclusion of the women's quarters, but she well knew what was going on outside. She had known overnight what was impending that day. Not unlikely she had heard it from Pilate himself, and the knowledge had made her restless. She feared what evil might come of it for Pilate, her husband. She had heard enough of Jesus to believe him true. She knew enough of the Jewish elders to suspect them. Her woman's instinct did the rest. All the night she had been unhappy. The trouble had brought weird dreams. She woke in the morning determined, if she could, to draw Pilate out of the whole affair. She cared for Pilate, which is not the least thing in his favor. She had influence over him, which is more. She had the courage and confidence to use this influence even in the midst of a judicial trial. As Pilate sat waiting for the answer of the people, a tablet was put in his hands on which were written these words, "Have thou nothing to do with that just man, for I have suffered many things this day in a dream because of him." From first to last, from the garden to Calvary, this was the only voice raised in the defense of Jesus. We do not wonder that the evangelist St. Matthew records it. We do not wonder that tradition has wished to honor the wife of Pilate. At length it was time for an answer to Pilate's question. While he had waited, the chief priests had done their work, and this time there was no one to check them. In the temple courts, Jesus had always opposed their malice, and always some had stood by him. Here, The enemy had it all their own way. It was their hour in the power of darkness. They had argued from presumption, which the ignorant could not deny. Presumption grew into assertion, and the sorry sight of Jesus before them seemed to confirm it. What the elders said might be true. Probably it was true. There were good reasons why it should be true. It was safer and wiser to say it was true. Then, surely, it was true. Common opinion became a common voice. If any still hesitated, their resistance was broken by the louder cries of the more reckless multitudes. After due time, Pilate stood up once more and renewed his question, "Which will you have of the two to be released to you?" There was only one answer to be heard. Violence is always louder mouthed than meekness, and the loud mouth speaks with a tongue infallible, which will brook no opposition. But the whole multitude cried out at once, saying, "Away with this man, and release unto us Barabbas." It was a momentous choice. It was the turning point of the whole tragedy. Now the die was cast. Even for the people who had joined in the cry, there was now no looking back. Pilate had opened a fresh sluice, and it only remained for him to be overwhelmed by the torrent. Still, like a drowning man, he would catch at any straw. Common justice compelled him not yet to yield. As he had himself declared, he had seen enough to know that the man before him was not guilty. He had spoken with him and had learnt to respect him, almost to revere him. Behind him, too, there was a strength which made the Roman governor fear, a strength which nothing his enemy said or did could bend, a strength and certainty in himself and in his own just cause, a strength, moreover, in something which Pilate could not fathom, which was not of this world, which gave to Jesus a peace beyond the reach of men's abuse. For other reasons, therefore, more than those of common justice, Pilate would save Jesus if he could. He did not know what God he might be offending, whose wrath he might incur if he injured that God's favorite. If Herod was made a coward from fear of a ghost, Pilate the Roman had no less the fear common among his fellow countrymen. He must make yet another attempt. He would appeal to those deeper things which had made so great an impression on himself, and which he knew meant so much more to the Jewish people. He could affect contempt in what he said. He could pretend it was not his concern. Yet, in his heart, he knew it was not all contempt. Jesus, the Christ, the Anointed, the word clearly had a meaning to the Jew, for the chief priests and elders had flung it at Jesus with exceeding bitterness. Jesus, the King of the Jews, whatever it might signify, he was sure by now that the title was no empty name. The accusers had been enraged because their victim had claimed these titles for himself. If they meant nothing, neither could the charge they contained have any meaning. No man could be put to death for claiming a title that meant nothing. No man could rouse against himself such bitter hatred by the mere adoption of a foolish, empty name. He would press these titles home. If the elders and priests rejected them, nevertheless the people might yet be moved. He would imply that, as judge, not only did he declare Jesus innocent of any crime, but also he believed him to be what he claimed to be. If still they would have his life, then, in the final judgment of the independent Roman court, it would not only be because Jesus claimed to be Christ the King, but because he was Christ the King in very truth. And Pilate spoke to them again, desiring to release Jesus. "What will you then that I do with Jesus, who is called the Christ, the King of the Jews?" And again he failed. Once more, the reminder of the truth did but aggravate them. The will not to believe is hard to convince. The determination not to accept what is known to be true is invincible. Indeed, to attempt to convince is to rouse the most violent kind of enmity. Hitherto, the accusers had only clamored for the condemnation of Jesus. They had asked that somehow he should be put to death. Apparently it mattered not how. Now, since they had been taunted with his being their Christ, their anointed king, they went to a further extreme. He must not only die, he must die the most shameful death that even the Roman world knew. He must die the death of a guilty slave, of a convicted criminal, though to be a Roman citizen would save even a criminal from such a fate. They're anointed? Let him be crucified. Then it would be known what they thought of him. Then even such men as Pilate would check their sarcastic tongues. But they all again cried out, "Crucify him! Crucify him! Let him be crucified!" This was indeed a climax of hatred, so that more than ever Pilate was amazed. He had seen passion roused to blind fury before. In his own city it was cultivated as an amusement. He had seen in Rome eyes glittering and faces taut, as women round the arena turned down their thumbs demanding a gladiator's death. He had seen his own soldiers, brutalized and hardened till they were scarcely human any longer, laughing and turning to sport the slaughter of the helpless. He had watched an Asiatic mob, more deliberate and merciless than any European, show its white teeth and express dread purpose in its eyes as it pursued some deed of callous cruelty. He had himself a heart hardened enough to pass suffering by, to inflict it if need be, and to be moved no more than if he plucked a lily. But this sight before him was different from all these. It was not fury. It was not blind. It was cold, deliberate, determined. There was too much hatred now even for mockery or laughter. Never before had a Jew or a Jewish mob demanded that a Jew should be crucified, no matter what might have been his crime. Pilate himself feared. If he persisted, he himself might incur their vengeance, for this was a hatred that would not be balked, that would not count the cost of its deeds. Weakly, he repeated what he had said before. The man was innocent. He had done nothing in any way deserving death. If he were chastised, it would be punishment enough. And Pilate said to them the third time, "Why? What evil hath he done? I find no cause of death in him. I will chastise him therefore, and let him go." The words, the repeated sentence, the unjust concession, the yet feebler opening question, only confirmed to the enemy that their case was won. They had only to persist in their demand, and all would be secured according to their will. Legality was now thrown to the winds. Its very forms could now be set aside. They had found a formula which admirably suited their purpose, and they needed but to repeat it to the very sound would seem its vindication. But they were the more instant with loud voices, "Crucify him, let him be crucified," and their voices prevailed.